This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And I didn't even know. I tried hard to forget the war like everybody did. Settled down, got married, even had a couple of kids. Well, my children both had birth defects, and the doctors had their doubts. They never could understand it, but I think I've figured it out. 'Cause I got the news this morning, yeah, the doctors told me so. They killed me in Vietnam, and I didn't even know. This Agent Orange from Vietnam, we carry it with us still. It stays inside for years and years before it starts to kill. You might get cancer of the liver, you might get cancer of the skin. You can file for disability, but you might not live to win. Oh, I got the news this morning, yeah, the doctors told me so. They killed me in Vietnam, and I didn't even know. Oh, the doctor said I've got some time trying to be kind. I've never been a radical, but this has changed my mind. Oh, I'd be so proud to hear my kids say, hell no, I won't go. Because you killed my dad in Vietnam, and he didn't even know. Yes, I'd be so proud to hear my kid say, hell no, I won't go. Because you killed my dad in Vietnam, and he didn't even know.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM in Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, or on the World Wide Web at KBOO.fm. I'm Marvin, along with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. We got a few announcements, and then we're going to talk to our guest, Professor Edwin Martini, who's written a great book on Agent Orange. That's why I played that Country Joe song this morning, and I thought it was just a good song to lead into for our program today.
Very appropriate.
Yeah. On Columbia River Fellowship of Peace on Saturday, March 16th, at Hood River Marina, will be holding a memorial for the dead of the Iraq and Afghanistan War. And that's March 16th, and it starts, I believe it started at 9 a.m. But if you need more information down there, you can call Dan Rowe, and he's at 541-400-0244, or you can call Keith Harding at 541-352-7500. And our good friend Linda Short from Hood River sent us that, and I hope folks go down there.
Hope you're listening, Linda.
Yeah, you're great, Linda. She's great. And on Tuesday, March 19th, Iraq, 10 years later, two events for peace at 3:30 to 5:30 p.m. Visibility action, U.S. out of Iraq, Southwest Broadway and Morrison in downtown Portland. And I think that's Portland Response, right? Peaceful Response?
Yes.
And I think that's those folks. And at 7 p.m. That same night, Tuesday night at 7 p.m., Eyewitness 10 Years Later, What Iraqis Are Saying, Kathy Breen, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, will be at the First Unitarian Church at the Elliott Chapel at 1011 Southwest 12th. And if you need more information, you can call Peace and Justice Works Iraqi Infinity Group, and their number is 503-236-3065, And that was sent to us by our good friend, Dan Handelman.
Dan the man.
Dan the man. And I'll leave. And also, this is a very good one. It's a celebrating 20 years of peace, friendship, and reconciliation, and the 15th anniversary of a very special place. And it's a springtime dinner benefit for Vietnam Friendship Village Project. And that's going to be Thursday, March 21st from 6 to 9. And that's going to be at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House. And that's at 4312 Southeast Stark here in Portland. And they're a very, very good group. I've been to out there at Friendship Village. It's just outside of Hanoi. And they work with Agent Orange folks. And it's very, very good. Becky sent this to us, and she called me yesterday. And she asked if we would announce it. And so that's Vietnam Friendship Village Project, springtime dinner benefit for the Friendship Village Project. And that's Thursday, March 21st, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House at 4312 Southeast Stark here in Portland. And if you need more information about that, you can call Becky, and her number is 503-774-9197. And it's really interesting because the last time I saw Becky was in Vietnam. I went over to the opera house in Hanoi to pick up Don Blackburn. He was going to spend some time in Hanoi with us. And Becky was there, and I saw Becky, and it was really nice seeing Becky in Vietnam. I ran into her over there a couple times. And so I'll be going back to Vietnam. I'm going on March 27th, and I'll be back on the 17th of April. I'm going back over with Bob Chenoweth. As you folks remember, we did an interview with Bob, and he was the prisoner of war for 5 years, and 2 years in the South Jungle prisons and 3 years up in Hanoi. And he was a member of the Peace Committee in the prison against the war in Vietnam. And we're going to go back. Lady Borton's helping us out. And we'll be visiting some spots that Bob had been in and meeting some of the people that he knew in the prisons. And it's going to be a very interesting trip. And I'll bring back some video and some sound from that trip. And it'll be very interesting. And it's Bob's first time back.
Oh, I was going to ask you, is this Bob's first time back?
Yeah, it's his first time back.
Since he was released?
Since he got out of the prison in 73. So it'll be his first time back. So it's going to be a very interesting trip. And we're lucky to have Lady Borton, you know, helping us out. Because Lady's been there since 67, I think. She went to Vietnam the first time with the Quakers.
She knows her way around.
Oh, she does, boy. And today our guest is Edwin A. Martinez, author of Agent Orange, History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty. He's a professor of history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he is also the author of another book. I'm having trouble with my microphone here. Of another book called Invisible Enemies, The American War on Vietnam, 1975 to 2000. And I've just gotten that book, and I've just started reading it. And it's one of the only books that I've found that talks about Vietnam after 75. There's another one called Brother Enemy that talks about what happened right after Vietnam and before they kicked everybody out. And that's a really good book, too. But this one's starting out to be a pretty interesting book, so I'm going to really enjoy reading it. And I want to thank you, Professor Martini, for coming on our show.
Not at all. Thanks for having me. Good to be with you guys.
Oh, it's wonderful having you here. The book, Agent Orange, History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty, and your book on Vietnam, the other book on Vietnam. How did you get interested in Vietnam?
Well, I'm one of the generation that was actually born after the war was over. I was born in the fall of 1975, a few months after Saigon fell. And so I grew up in, you know, post-Vietnam America, where the echoes of the war were seemingly everywhere in the culture. But when I got into high school, I loved history and I was a big student of it. But our history curriculum stopped with the second bomb on Nagasaki. Uh-huh. We didn't learn anything about the Cold War or Vietnam or civil rights or the women's movement or anything. So when I went to college out of Pitzer College in the 90s, I basically majored in the 60s and minored in Vietnam and just soaked up everything I could about it and was just fascinated. And so I went to eventually went to grad school and was looking for a dissertation topic and was surprised, you know, a few decades later that there still really hadn't been anything written, much written at least, about that post-75 period. And so I started exploring that, and that's where the first book, Invisible Enemies, came from.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. Like I said, I just started reading it, and I think it's going to be really good, and I'm glad you wrote it. How many times have you been to Vietnam? I know you went to Vietnam.
Yeah, I went twice. I went once in, 2001 when I was still in grad school. I was working on my dissertation, which became the basis for Invisible Enemies. And then I went back when I was working on the Agent Orange book, 2007, and spent about a month over there in 2007 just talking to folks on the ground, people who were really working on the front lines with Agent Orange victims there and talking with veterans and caregivers and those folks. And so I'm hoping to go back soon. I'm a little jealous, Marv, that you're heading back there. A few days, it sounds like. It's an amazing place.
I'll get back
as soon as I can.
Yeah, I've been back maybe 12 times. The first time I went back was in 94, and I go back about every year and a half. But did you go to the Friendship Village?
I did on this last trip. Yeah. I did. I spent a day out there talking with folks and seeing all the amazing work that they're doing.
Oh, they're doing great work. Great work. And the people who started that was a Vietnam vet. So that's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. Pretty good. Your book, Agent Orange, tell people what Agent Orange is.
Well, Agent Orange was sort of the operational name, sort of a nickname given to a herbicide that was used by the United States and its allies during the Vietnam War. It's a combination of two herbicides, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, that were sort of commercially available and in wide use in the U.S. and around the world in the early 60s, and it was one of what came to be known as the rainbow herbicides used by the U.S. in Vietnam. So there was Agent Pink, Agent Green, Agent Purple, Agent Blue, Agent White, and then Agent Orange. And they were nicknamed this because of the color of the band that was placed on the 55-gallon drums that they were shipped in. And they were mostly variations on the same herbicide. Agent Orange was introduced in 1965 and then continued through 1971. Some of the herbicides were introduced as early as 1961. And they were used, all those different chemicals were used for two different purposes. One was to defoliate the landscape, the jungle, the thick terrain there, with the idea that the U.S. forces would have a better chance of finding NLF soldiers if they could clear out the forests a little bit. And then the other mission that they were used for was crop destruction. They targeted what the military believed to be sources of food that were supplying the revolutionary forces of Vietnam, but unfortunately they also were being used by a lot of civilians in the area. So it was one of six different herbicides that were used, but it became the most infamous because it was the most widely used.
And the dangerous part of it is the 2,4-5-T and the 2,4-D, if I got that right?
Yeah, it's the two different chemicals, and the one that's really most famous is the 2,4-5-T, because that it was impossible to produce 2,4-5-T as a herbicide without producing a chemical contaminant called dioxin. And just in producing it, it was a normal part of the chemical reaction that there would be dioxin included as sort of a byproduct in the herbicides. And there were a couple others that had 2,4-5-T in it as well. Actually, most of those rainbow herbicides did. And the dioxin levels would vary based on which chemical company was producing it. Dow Chemical here in Michigan produced a lot of Agent Orange, but they found a way early on to actually limit the amount of dioxin that went into the Agent Orange. And they tried to get some of the other chemical companies to limit their amounts too, basically by doing a slower and lower temperature chemical reaction. But there was a lot of money being made. There was a lot of demand for the herbicides because of agriculture and other uses, as well as what the Pentagon was asking for. And so, unfortunately, a lot of these herbicides ended up with potentially high levels of dioxin in them. And dioxin, as we find out later, has some pretty significant potential impacts for the environment and then for human health as well, for people who are exposed to high amounts.
Yeah, the one thing that people, when they hear Agent Orange, I mean, they just think that the Agent Orange is what made people sick, but it was that dioxin that was in the Agent Orange. And if I know you probably went in Ho Chi Minh City, you went to the war. It used to be called the War Crimes Museum, and they've changed that name. And they have that whole section in there on Agent Orange. Did you go in? Did you go there?
I did. Oh. I had been there once in 2001, but I hadn't been paying particularly close attention to Agent Orange at that point. So I went back a few years ago and revisited it. And they've still got a pretty extensive exhibit there on Agent Orange. And, you know, again, the focus is always on Agent Orange. But you're right. It is the dioxin in there. And then there's the other chemicals as well. A lot of the other rainbow herbicides had 2,4-5-T in them as well.
Yeah, they because I can remember when I was in Vietnam in 1968, and I can remember the spraying that in the areas that we were in, and sometimes, you know, they sprayed it in other areas that we went into. And but when they spray that stuff, it gets all over you. I mean, it got all over us. I remember one time we were digging in the afternoon, and the planes came over spraying. I think there's 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 of them, and they were spraying, and we saw them coming. And so we tried to get out of the way and get underneath some trees and stuff, but we got it all over us. You know, you have your shirt off, and it got all over our skin and everything, and it was really, really sticky.
Right.
And we tried to wipe it off and everything, and that happened a lot. And then within a day, man, everything was dead. You know, and everything was dead. And so about, I think maybe three or four weeks later, me and the guy that really got sprayed hard, we broke out in pimples, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's called chloracne.
Right.
Yeah.
And we went to the medic and we said, man, look at this. What is this? It was just like pimples. It was on our face and on our shoulders and part of our backs. And the medic, you know, he really didn't know anything. And he says, well, how old are you? And I said, well, I'm 19. He says, well, you got pimples, you know?
But you didn't have them a day before.
I didn't have them 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And so he came in, you know, and so that was a lot of the stuff. And but that's one of them that happened pretty quick, and the rest of them takes a while for that stuff to kick in. And so that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, chloracne is one of the few, if any, sort of universal signs for high levels of dioxin exposure. When there were major domestic accidents, there was a big accident at the Nitro plant out in West Virginia back in the 40s, and people who were exposed in these chemical plants to high levels of dioxin immediately broke out, as you did, in sort of this chloracne, like a really bad kind of pimply rash.
Yeah.
But what we didn't know, what people didn't necessarily know at the time, we found out towards the end of the war as more research was being done, that it also had potentially really damaging long-term effects, especially for different kinds of cancer and different things that we know that veterans were affected by later on, as well as Vietnamese civilians.
Yeah, the Vietnamese really took it tough, because one of the things, when you were doing your studying over there, I don't know if you talked to Lady Borton or Chuck Searcy while you were there.
I did not. I've emailed back and forth with Chuck a little bit, and I unfortunately have never had the chance to meet Lady Borton, but I certainly know of her.
Oh, yeah, she's wonderful. Her and Chuck have been working on Agent Orange for a long time. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they were telling me is that for years people thought that, you know, the guys out in the field were the ones that got hit with Agent Orange, you know, and the other dioxins and that pretty heavy. But as in your book, It's not true. I mean, it's true that we got hit, but
right.
The hot spots, talk about the hot spots in Vietnam.
Yeah, for a long time, you know, as people were learning more and more about dioxin and Agent Orange, they were trying to figure out patterns for figuring out how veterans got exposed, why they got exposed, and then under what conditions. And nobody was really looking at the bases where this stuff was being stored. And so from the work of people like Wayne Dwernichuk, who's a scientist who worked on this, Arnold Schechter, they basically came up with this hotspot theory, because they were finding these really, even to this day, this is in like the 1990s, they're finding these really high levels of dioxin in people's blood and in breast milk and in some of the animal tissues that they're sampling in areas around Da Nang, which was one of the biggest bases used for this, and then Binh Hoa, just outside of Saigon. And so they started theorizing, basically, that these areas were actually the most contaminated in Vietnam. So it's not that people didn't get sprayed directly, But actually, one of the most dangerous places to be if you were in Vietnam was sort of, as you guys would have said at the time, Marv, in the rear with the gear. If you were on that Binh Hoa base or at Da Nang, if you were working with this stuff, we know that the dioxin from those barrels, because they weren't handled properly or they weren't disposed of properly, it leaked into the soil. And it gets into the soil, and then over the last couple decades, it's gotten into the food chain in Vietnam. So it goes into the soil, the bugs eat it, the fish eat the bugs, and the people eat the fish. And so that becomes a really significant environmental contamination problem in terms of long-term damage, because it just keeps replicating itself. And we didn't know that for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, the thing that's interesting about that, too, is Operation Ranch Hand. Can you tell the folks what Ranch Hand was?
Sure. Ranch Hand was sort of the final name given to an operation. It went by a couple different names early on, responsible for spraying the majority of the herbicide missions in Vietnam. So when you guys saw those planes go over, they were most likely Ranch Hand aircraft. And so people had for a long time been looking at trying to track where the spray missions occurred and whether or not there were troops or civilians in the path, in the swath of folks that would have gotten hit by that. But it's really where the Ranch Hand missions originated. It was at the areas where these barrels of Agent Orange were stored, and these huge pyramids of barrels. There's a bunch of pictures of them in the book, and the big holding tanks. And stuff was spilling out onto the runway as they were loading the planes and the tankers. And so long term, it's the Ranch Hand missions, sort of the logistics behind it at those bases, that's as responsible as anything for the ongoing contamination in Vietnam. And really most of the civilian health problems that we see in Vietnam today related to Agent Orange are from the hotspots, not from areas that were sprayed 30, 40 years ago.
Right. Also, something that was interesting in your book is when you were talking about the planes would take off, and sometimes they would be leaking as they took off and dump their load. Sometimes they would, you know, and so they never even thought about. Did they know? Did the chemical companies know the long term effects of these dioxins on the population?
The chemical companies knew about some of the dangers. They had been testing. They knew from experiments, or not experiments, but accidents that had happened in some of their facilities, Dow and Monsanto and some of these other companies, because their own workers had been exposed to it, and they had done some studies of them, so they knew about chloracne. They had also been testing on animals, and they knew, for instance, early on, before Agent Orange was even introduced into Vietnam, that it was a potential carcinogen, a cancer-causing agent in rats and lab animals, as well as a teratogen causing birth defects in those animals. So they knew that it was the case for lab animals, which should have raised some concerns. They didn't necessarily know all the long-term problems that were going to be associated with dioxin. Not a lot of people did at that time because it was still relatively new and there was still a pretty small group of people that knew about it and was doing research on it. But we do have the documents, most of which came to light during the veterans class action suit in the 70s and 80s, that revealed that the chemical companies did in fact know a lot about the potential dangers, even if it wasn't confirmed yet. What's not clear, and there's no evidence that they ever told the Pentagon or told any civilian military leaders about these dangers.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the things, in fact, when I talked to you on the phone one time, is in your book, and I'd never ever thought about it, was that they tried to start forest fires.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
They did. you know, this is one of actually my favorite is the wrong word, but I think it's one of the most interesting stories I came across during the course of the book. The whole idea behind Ranch Hand was this idea that through these chemicals we could gain a little bit more control over the environment. That, you know, the troops that we were sending over there, even the troops that we were training over there, the South Vietnamese troops, they were sort of out of their element down in the Mekong Delta and places like that. And so that if we could alter the environment by changing the landscape, we would have a better chance for success. And so they were having trouble figuring out the best way to do that. And so one of the ideas that they toyed with was setting these massive forest fires that would basically do large scale what they were trying to do with some of the herbicides. And so several operations in the mid-1960s, they actually tried to set these forest fires. So they would come through and they would defoliate it with Agent Orange and Agent Blue and try to dry out the landscape. And then they would come through a couple weeks later and they would drop tons of napalm on it and firebomb it and then come by with some other bombing raids. And they basically tried to ignite these forest fires, and they try and try and try, but the forest just absolutely will not burn. I mean, Marv, you've been to Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
Humid, and it's tropical, thick rainforest, and it just would not burn. So the best they could do was, in, I forget if it's 67 or 69, but there's a huge fire raging down on the southern tip of the Mekong Delta. And it started by natural causes, a lightning strike or something. And so even though the military couldn't start it, they kept trying to exacerbate it. They tried to clear the areas around it so it would spread even more. And they actually at some point fired on some of the civilians who were hopelessly trying to put it out with water and these kind of things. So the best they could do was sort of join a regularly scheduled fire already in progress.
Already in progress. Yeah, and I'd never, Professor, I'd never heard of that. I'd never... Of all the books I've read on Vietnam and being there and everything, I've never heard that they tried to start forest fires. That is
beyond me. I was in the archives one day looking for documents and just came across this whole file that was called Forest Fire as a Military Weapon. It was just hundreds and hundreds of documents and studies that, you know, involved the U.S. Forest Service and other folks trying to just set these massive forest fires.
Yeah, you know, let's get talk now about the things that you talk about, especially these the Vietnamese were in charge of the empty barrels. Weren't they in charge of the empty barrels after the...
In part, there that a lot of the ARVN, the Republic of Vietnam Army, were charged with that. But it's pretty clear that a lot of American servicemen were involved in various... activities regarding the barrels as well.
Yeah, but when the Vietnamese people would use these barrels, that they were contaminated.
Right,
there's just
right.
no way that those barrels weren't contaminated, and that got out into the general public like that.
Exactly. So you know, like with a lot of things in the military, there were very clear procedures on paper for how these barrels were meant to be disposed of. You know, emptied, and then they were supposed to be rinsed, placed on a drying rack, and then re-rinsed, and then eventually crushed and repurposed. But we have all sorts of evidence that shows that this wasn't happening. I mean, we have pictures of just these wastelands of barrels strewn about these bases in Da Nang and Binh Hoa, where they were leaking into the soil. But then they were also really valuable commodities. And so both Americans and Vietnamese soldiers working on these bases would sell them basically on the black market to the folks who were living around the bases. And if anybody out there has ever tried to empty a 55-gallon drum, you know if you can't quite get that last little bit of liquid out of the bottom. It's really hard. So there was residue from these herbicides containing dioxin in the barrels. And then people would go off and they would fill them up with drinking water. They would fill them up with gasoline and then put them into their motorbikes. And so a lot of dioxin got spread. It would have been fairly diffuse, but it was still spread out into the general population off the base in that way.
Yeah, and yeah, that's a real problem too. And when the war was winding down, and they were having to get rid of all this Agent Orange, and they were trying to figure out how to get rid of it, and one of the things that in your book talks about is they were going to burn it.
Yep.
Talk about that. Where were they going to burn it, and how were they going to burn it?
Well, they looked at at least 14, I think, different options for how to get rid of this stuff, because they had 2.4, 2.7 million gallons of this stuff laying around, and barely anybody wanted it. There were a few folks here and there, ranchers and some other foreign governments who wanted it, but the Air Force needed to get rid of it. So they looked at all different kinds of scenarios, and the best one they could come up with was incineration, because incineration was actually a scientifically proven way to get rid of the dioxin that was present in that. You could burn it at a high degree that would destroy all but a trace of the dioxin molecule. So they were going to originally do it at a couple of domestic incinerator plants, one down in Texas and one in St. Louis. But as you can imagine, these communities wanted nothing to do with that, because by this time, everybody knew what Agent Orange was. Everybody knew what dioxin was, or more people were finding out what dioxin was, and the Environmental Protection Agency has been created in the meantime. People were thinking about these things differently. So eventually what they did was they shipped all the Agent Orange off to Johnston Atoll, which is about 800 miles southwest of Hawaii. It's a military base that we had controlled since before World War II. And they put it all there, and then they put it on a Dutch ship called the MT Vulcanus, and it's in a specially designed chemical incineration ship. They drove this out west of Johnston, out into this burn zone in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific, and they burned it. And actually, by all accounts, this was a pretty successful, environmentally safe operation. Out of all the different things they could have done with the Agent Orange, that was probably the most responsible and the safest way to deal with it.
Yeah, one of the things that interests me, too, I'm going to jump back into Vietnam again, was that the National Liberation Front was coming out and talking about Agent Orange, you know, that it was used to kill the crops and it would kill the people, and they were using that as a way of recruiting, and the South Vietnamese and the Americans were saying it's not a problem. So that was
exactly,
it. They were
yeah.
like they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. Bill, we're talking to just a second. Bill wants to talk to you.
Sure.
We're talking to Edwin Martinez, the author of Agent Orange: History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty. And this is Veterans Voice Radio, and we're on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And Bill has a question, Edwin.
Yes.
Sure.
Is there any evidence to the effect, or to the effect that the GIs themselves knew of the danger of handling this stuff, and were there any provisions made for them for protective clothing or gear that would help them deal with it? You know, cause them less exposure, I guess.
Not consistently, certainly, Bill. A lot of the instructions that would have come with this stuff in a major shipment did have modest warnings about, you know, use safely, you know, but it was more like don't drink this kind of stuff, you know, and handle properly. But, you know, for those of you who were there and, you know, you're 19 and it's 120 degrees out and it's humid, you're out there working without a shirt off. Even if you had gotten those kind of warnings, you probably weren't going to take them too seriously. But they're because the military itself was not aware of significant long-term problems. So it falls under the same kind of category of kind of common sense usage for this stuff. But I've heard stories, and there's actually a picture in the book where these guys are out doing perimeter-based defoliation, and they've got their shirts off, and they're having a beer, and I've talked to guys who sprayed each other as though it were just kind of a fire extinguisher, and they're goofing around, and it's directly on their skin. So even if they did shower afterwards, if you were doing that repeatedly, you would have gotten a lot of exposure. But no protective gear at all was given to the guys who were out in the field. Some of the folks who worked on ranch hand operations at the air bases and, for instance, were loading the stuff regularly on the planes might have had a little bit of protective gear on them because they were doing it every single day. But for guys who were out in the field and doing this on base perimeters and stuff, no, they wouldn't have had any protective gear.
Yeah, I was just looking at in the book here. I have the book with me. And you're right. I looked at that picture of those guys spraying that around their base camp, and that's how it happened. I was at a fire support base one time, and they were spraying the perimeter, and they had a three-quarter ton truck on the back. They had a spraying machine, and the guys were just walking by it and by the truck, and they were just spraying this stuff just all over the place, you know, and they had their shirts off, and it was no big deal to them.
Yeah, and, you know, people are a little bit shocked sometimes, especially younger folks who hear these stories. But if they think back, and you guys might remember this, you know, back in the 50s, we were spraying DDT, driving down the streets and at the beach, and they're just, you know, spraying these insecticides all over the place with no thought. I mean, part of the story in the book is that the way we think about these kind of chemicals and the way we think about the environment and the health of the human body undergoes a really profound transformation right about this same time. It really overlaps with ranch hand and the Vietnam War, so that the way we were thinking about this stuff in the 50s and 60s, the way that the soldiers who were there would have grown up with, is completely transformed by the time we get into the mid-1970s. So the guys who were working on the incineration of Agent Orange are wearing protective gear and aprons and gloves and goggles because we had understood these things very differently. So it's not just a story of neglect or, you know, bad information. It's really a fundamental shift in the way that we think about these things, too.
Yeah, that's true. And in your book, it's really interesting too, is that the military hired Vietnamese women to help decontaminate these things, and these women weren't wearing aprons, they weren't wearing masks, they you know, barefooted or wearing sandals, and they were cleaning this out. And then the next thing, I'm looking at this book, and there's this guy, he's got goggles on, he's got gloves on, he's got everything, he's protecting himself pretty good. But when they were doing it over there, they didn't know, and I think they knew, But it was just so much of it, and they just wanted to get rid of it. And so that brings us back to, we started talking about burning it on that ship. And let's talk about now, let's talk about the lawsuits.
Okay.
Let's talk about the lawsuits, because there's quite a few. And one of them was right here in Oregon. And remember, talk about that. Talk about Alsea.
Alsea. So there were a bunch of these cases that came about sort of in the late 70s, and then some of them spilled over into the early 1980s, where especially once people had become aware of Agent Orange and the threats of herbicides and these things with this new kind of environmental consciousness, people were very concerned about not just what had happened in Vietnam, but the extent to which these same chemicals were being used domestically in agriculture and forestry and to clear roads. And so the Forest Service actually had been using similar herbicides with 2,4-5-T in them over in the Alsea, over in that part of the state. And it's a really, I've never been there. You guys probably know it
it's
pretty
forest,
well. But
foresty.
It was a pretty small community, and suddenly there was a rash of spontaneous abortions, that women were having a lot of trouble with pregnancies out there. But unfortunately, because it's a small sample size, there was a lot of debate about whether or not it was caused by the herbicides and whether or not there could be anything conclusive. And that is sort of part and parcel of what the debates about surrounding the lawsuits were out about, not whether or not people had even been exposed, but if there was any way to definitively link exposure to herbicides with particular health problems, especially with birth defects, where the science was even more difficult to show the kind of causality that the lawsuits and the courts were going to require. So also becomes one of the many cases where people are trying to determine whether or not herbicide exposure was responsible for particular health concerns.
Yeah, and talk about the city in Missouri. That just, I had never heard about that until I read your book. The city in Missouri, that is just, tell the people the story about that. That is unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, Times Beach, it's Times Beach, Missouri, which is now the home of the Route 66 State Park, just a little bit outside of St. Louis. And I, before I was researching the book, I hadn't heard of it either, but people kept referencing it, so I did some work on it. And basically, I mean, it's a fascinating story.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
Outside of St. Louis, there had been home to a lot of chemical companies in the 50s and 60s after World War II. And one of them had produced a variety of products and then eventually produced 2,4-5-T as well. It was producing the same kind of herbicide. And they had these, basically they had these dioxin residues in their reactors. And they probably hadn't been following real good procedures. They weren't really closely regulated at that time early on. And they contracted with a guy to come basically haul off their waste. And then what he did was he would mix it with other kinds of waste oil from all sorts of different companies and different groups. And then he used it as a dust suppressant, which a lot of people would have done at the time out on like horse ranches and these kind of things. They would spray these dirt roads to keep the dust down. And a lot of the stuff that he sprayed was heavily contaminated with dioxin, much higher concentrations than would have been in Agent Orange used in the war. Really dangerous stuff. And so kids started getting sick and horses started dying. It was really ugly. So they basically traced it back to this. And so it had kind of an Agent Orange connection, but again, it demonstrated to people the dangers of dioxin. And then what really complicated it even further is that Times Beach sat on the banks of the Merrimack River, which in the early 80s then flooded and really spread the dioxin all over the town. And people didn't know what to do, and they were unable to determine, you know, what the risk levels were for people. So eventually the federal government comes in and bought out the town. They bought out everybody's house and it basically turned the place into a ghost town. And then this is happening at the same time that the veterans class action suit is going on. So you've got the government on the one hand saying, no, Agent Orange isn't responsible for health concerns to the veterans. But then the same chemical that everybody's talking about, the dioxin from 2,4-5-T, is in this town. Now, granted, it's at much higher levels. But still, the message for veterans was obviously, you know, you clearly don't care about us. You're not concerned about our health, and you're lying to us, they think. But meanwhile, you're taking care of all these civilians in this town in Times Beach for what they saw as the same problem.
Yeah. Bill, did you have a question?
Yes. Since the U.S. military has a reputation of being the major polluter in the entire world,
True, true.
They're going to kill us one way or another. They're either going to, we're going to die at the end of a gun barrel, or we're going to die of poisoning. I was a part of the atomic test back in the 50s at Desert Rock, and we're still suffering from the vestiges of that. The people, the downwinders, the clan of the one-breasted women, and so I'm not sure that the government doesn't know, in as much as they just don't give a damn.
That could be possible.
Well, they certainly weren't asking those kind of questions. I think that's fair, that they might not have been interested, but there's still, you know, a lot of people are absolutely convinced that, you know, the Pentagon and McNamara and the Kennedy and Johnson administrations knew about Agent Orange. And there's really just, if you go back and read the conversations these guys were having, they weren't really asking those questions. But to the extent that they were not at all talking about the health concerns about it. So part of it is that military mindset, I think, where they are not necessarily concerned about the impact. But part of it, again, also is the way that we thought about these chemicals was very different in the late 1950s. I mean, the nuclear question, Bill, is different, I think.
Yeah.
These guys are not known as deep thinkers, and they're running the country.
Yeah, that's
the world, for that matter.
Yeah, that's the Agent Orange and the atomic vets. I mean, that's really a blight on our country, the way that was done. I want to talk to you a little bit about one chapter that really I thought was really interesting in your book. Agent Orange, History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty, is the politics of uncertainty. Talk about that. That is interesting.
Yeah, and I was working on the book, and I was having a hard time figuring out exactly how I was going to frame this stuff. And there's been a lot of good work done in environmental history and from public health historians who have looked at things like tobacco and the role that tobacco companies played in promoting the idea of scientific uncertainty, so that, you know, you couldn't necessarily link nicotine exposure or cigarette smoke to a particular disease. And in a lot of ways, I think the chemical companies played a very similar role here, and to a certain degree, the government did as well, in promoting the idea of uncertainty. Because on the one hand, I mean, basically the argument in the book is that you can't ever show definitively, in almost any case, that exposure to Agent Orange or one of these herbicides at any point in time caused a specific condition. I mean, we just... the veterans were not getting the benefit of the doubt on a lot of different fronts in terms of the care they were getting at the VA in general, in terms of employment, in terms of, you know, assumptions about drug use and mental stability, all these kind of things. And Agent Orange is all tied up in that. And so the burden of the proof to show Agent Orange exposure and to prove your case was really strong for guys like Paul Reuterschan and some of these early vets who were involved in the lawsuit. That changes over the next decade. And based on basically political organizing and some of the pressure that people are able to bring with powerful allies, sometimes in Congress, they were able to basically shift the burden of proof back onto the VA, so that when we eventually get some more progressive Agent Orange legislation for veterans, the veterans no longer really have to demonstrate exposure. There's a presumption of exposure eventually, long after the fact, for any veteran who was in South Vietnam during the war. And these boundaries keep getting expanded over time. And so it's really, it's they're able to shift the politics of uncertainty in a way that takes the burden of proof off the veterans and puts it back on the VA. But at the same time, the U.S. government is taking a completely different stance with regard to Vietnamese civilians, for instance.
Yeah, that's interesting. Bill's going to have a question in a minute. But,
sure.
But the... This seems like that these chemical companies continually were hiding behind that. You know, they were getting the benefit of the doubt was for them, you know.
Yep.
So they were saying, well, you know, well, they can't prove it. They can't disprove it. You can't prove it. So
exactly.
We win. You know, they win. Instead of saying, well, you know, the government should have said, well, you know, we can't this way, but so the veterans win. But, you know, but that's changing because now there's a long list of diseases and things that are service-connected including diabetes. And exactly. So that's really changed, and your book talks about that. Mm-hmm. And Bill wanted to ask you.
Yeah, something. I was going to ask you. We interviewed a couple of women who were children of Vietnam mm-hmm. vets mm-hmm. who had been exposed to dioxin or Agent Orange, mm-hmm. and they were suffering from birth defects mm-hmm. as a result of their parents or their father's exposure. And I was wondering how these birth defects are mutations, and how long will they be with us? Are the mutations going to continue to be a part of our existence?
Well, I think, the best answer I have for that, if I'm being honest, is we don't know. Yeah. The area of birth defects is by far the most contentious, even among very sympathetic scientists who've been working with children of veterans and with Vietnamese children for decades now. And it's even more difficult to show any kind of linkage between herbicide exposure to Agent Orange and birth defects than it is to show these other conditions that are covered now by the VA. And so I think part of it is that we don't know, because at some level, with a lot of these birth defects, we don't know that Agent Orange is even responsible. And this is particularly true in Vietnam, where we've got even more challenges with record keeping and figuring out, you know, where people were during the war and where they lived and how they were exposed and these kind of things, whether they got it through the food chain. I think the bigger threat, frankly, is in Vietnam, because of the degree to which it was in the food chain for so long after the war.
Mm-hmm.
As far as veterans, children of veterans, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of veterans here in the U.S., I think it's more likely that those will dissipate over time. But again, it's really hard to know exactly in most of these cases whether or not they're even caused by Agent Orange.
Right. Right now the VA is spina bifida, for
that
sure.
Is,
they
yeah.
they accept spina bifida as being a
yeah.
problem. And I've talked to a lot of Vietnam vet nurses and women who had, not just nurses, but women who had been in Vietnam. And they were saying when they came home, they had a lot of trouble getting pregnant,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And if they did get pregnant, they never carried the babies for full term,
mm-hmm.
you know? And they were just having this really hard time, getting pregnant. And the women in Vietnam were, I've heard it so many times, these women who were in the National Liberation Front or in the North Vietnamese Army that went south, they were saying the same thing, you know, that, gee, we couldn't get pregnant. Or if we got pregnant, we couldn't carry our babies, you know. They aborted automatically, so.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the developments that's come more recently with some of this stuff is not with the 2,4-5-T, but with the 2,4-D, the mm. other ingredient in there, which is still widely used around the U.S. and elsewhere. It's the active ingredient in things like Roundup. And there's a lot of people who believe that 2,4-D, while not a carcinogen in the same way that 2,4-5-T is, acts as an endocrine disruptor.
Oh.
And, you know, we're learning more and more about these kind of things that are coming, PCBs and endocrine disruptors that are in all sorts of products. I mean, they're so pervasive. And, there might be ways in which 2,4-D from some of these chemicals was having significant impacts on the reproductive systems of folks involved. But even with the early experiments with lab rats, for instance, it was usually the female rats where the scientists were seeing the most problems, rather than with, for instance, the sperm in the male rat.
Right, right.
So, you know, female veterans, nurses, and folks who would have been exposed to this stuff, I think it is more likely that they would have had greater reproductive and health challenges as a result in terms of their kids than the male vets.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think that that's true also. And I think that with us guys, I think that as time goes by, the diseases we have as we get older, because as you know, that the dioxin is in our fatty tissue.
Right, exactly.
And as we get older and we get weaker, our immune system gets weaker, that stuff starts coming out, and we're going to have a real problem once that stuff starts hitting into our bloodstreams as we get older. And one of the things that Agent Orange is heart disease. And,
mm-hmm.
Man, I've had a string of my Vietnam vet buddies, man, in the last month die of heart attacks that you would have never, ever thought would have a heart attack, you know?
Yeah.
And that's going to be a real problem with us guys is as we get older and our bodies get weaker and that starts coming out of us. We don't have much time left, and I want to – can you just give us a good summary before we let you go about about your book and what you want to say about it.
About the Agent Orange book?
Yep.
Yeah, I think, you know, at its heart, I think the book is really about sort of the human desire to try to control things on the one hand and have certainty on the other hand. I mean, the reason that they really used this stuff in the first place is because scientists and military leaders and politicians in the 50s and 60s believed that they could control nature. That was the whole idea behind herbicides, that we could somehow harness that power and control nature. And they realized with a lot of things, I mean, if Vietnam taught us nothing else, it was that there was a lot of things that were outside the control of the United States. And then later on, people are really looking for answers, and they want answers to the kind of questions. And so much of the whole idea of the politics of certainty is about people wanting to know definitively why they're sick or why their dad died, whatever. And our inability to know at a certain level what these things are. And so it's really it reconstructs the history of Agent Orange, what it was, how it was used, and how people encountered it. But it's also really about the limits of what we can know, even with the best scientific evidence and all this experimentation, and even with lots of historical documentations, there's certain things that we're just never going to know. And I think people naturally want to assign blame. They want to know why they're sick, and they want to know why these things happened. And at a certain level, we're never going to know the answer to those questions. So the best we can do is try to make better moral, ethical, and political judgments. If we want to take care of our veterans and make sure that they've got health care, then we should decide to do that, not worry about, you know, the limits of scientific causality and proof. If we want to, you know, clean up the mess we left behind in Vietnam, then we should decide to do that and not wait for the courts to force the chemical companies to do that. So I think it's about the history of Agent Orange, but it also tries to tap into some of these larger epistemological but also ethical questions.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a really a good book, and I'm glad you wrote it, and I'm sure that our listeners are here in the United States and around the world are going to read your book now, and both of your books, Invisible Enemies and also the Agent Orange book. And if you write another book about Vietnam or something you think would be interesting, you got my number, and
okay,
you got
my
email address. You call me and let me know, and we'll sure talk about it.
I will. I'm working on a new book on the history of napalm. So
oh, my gosh.
That one's done.
Oh, God. Good, man. Let me know. Because that's really a soft boy, I tell you, thank you. Okay, I want to thank you, Edwin, for coming on the show and talking about your book. And thanks a lot, buddy. You did a great job.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, guys. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Edwin A. Martini. He's a professor at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's written the book Invisible Enemies, The American War on Vietnam, 1975 to 2000. And his newest book is Agent Orange, History, Science, and the Politics of Uncertainty. And like he was saying, that we don't know what's going to happen with Agent Orange on the people of Vietnam in the long run, or on us guys in the long run, and especially on our women veterans. What's going to be the long-term effects on our women veterans? So we have to really look around and see what's going to happen. We still have our veterans from Gulf War I who came back with Gulf War syndrome that they're still not dealing with, and those folks are really sick, and those men and women are still suffering from that, and the government is still dragging their feet on that. And so it's going to be a long, hard battle. I'm going to be gone. I leave on the 27th or 28th of March. I'll be back on the 17th. Our next show is going to be on April 19th at 9 a.m., and it's going to be a story about World War II. It's going to be about a platoon that fought, Marines that fought in the Pacific during World War II, and you're going to be really surprised in how those guys thought about that war. It's a different look. It's what these guys really thought about the war they were fighting in the Pacific. It's an amazing book. And we're going to be talking to the author of that, whose father was one of those Marines, and the way they felt about the war and the way the war was carried out. And so thanks for listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. We'll be back on April 19th at 9 a.m. And there it is. And thanks a lot. We'll talk to you later.
We set up in this bunker with rounds coming in. I'd like to be the president talking to the press instead of hearing caisson with shrapnel in my chest.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland, where the time is 10 a.m.